Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 409th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of program and practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada, and I'm a professor at the University of Alberta. Today, we're reaching out again to the crew in Edmonton to get, actually, not even Edmonton.
That's right.
This is a derelict site.
Yeah.
Red Deer.
Yeah. We're scraping the bottom of the barrel now.
We looked everywhere, and after all of that, we chose you, Adrian. Yeah. Adrian, why don't you introduce yourself to the team?
Sure. So I'm Adrian Lindblad. I'm the Knowledge Translation and Evidence Coordinator for the Alberta College of Family Physicians and Associate Clinical Professor in Family Medicine at the University of Alberta. And I live in Red Deer, which is a beautiful city, just really, really, really cold.
Yeah. And that's 12 months a year.
Yeah, exactly.
So today we're going to be doing a discussion about a tools of practice that just recently came out. And it's, I think, a topic that is certainly very common in primary care. And it's all about the use of antibiotics for abscesses and so on. And we're going to, why don't you run us through the question there, Adrian, and then we'll look at some of the evidence.
You betcha. So this was actually a question that came up with a PharmD student that I had, and really wanting to know if adding antibiotics to incision and drainage for single uncomplicated skin abscesses actually improves cure rates. So that's what we wanted to look at. And historically, there's been a couple of systematic reviews and a number of guidelines, including the Infectious Disease Society of America, that said there's really no improvement when you add antibiotics to incision and drainage. And so that was kind of the standing thought.
Well, that was the mantra for decades.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Because there really wasn't a lot of evidence at all. Well, there was evidence that it didn't do anything.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. And then back last year, we actually had two new systematic reviews come out that changed that quite a bit. And the biggest studies in both of these were two very high quality randomized controlled trials, both of them published in the New England Journal of Medicine. And so they really changed the results of these systematic reviews and has really changed, I think, everyone's thinking about the role antibiotics could play. So these two systematic reviews, one had four RCTs, one had 14, so about 2,000 to 4,000 patients in each of them. The reason for the difference is the one that only had four only included studies with antibiotics that have activity against MRSA. And so that was clindamycin or sulfamethoxazole, trimethoprim. And then the other one included other studies as well of antibiotics. So again, I mentioned that there was these two high-quality studies. They both had about 1,000 patients in each of these studies, and they randomized patients to either trimethoprim, sulfamethoxazole, or placebo in the one, and the other used clindamycin, trimethoprim, sulfamethoxazole, or placebo, and they included both adults and children. All of the patients had single abscesses. They were small, less than 5 centimeters, not complicated at all, and they had already undergone incision and drainage. The prevalence of MRSA was about 45%, which is fairly standard, and we've kind of, James and I were talking about this before, of trying to exactly estimate the prevalence of MRSA globally is challenging because it is so different from center to center and population to population, but 45% doesn't sound crazy out there.
Yeah, and it's always tricky, and this is going back to my ID days, you know, what's the prevalence of something that makes you change? And
did we have ID back in 1880?
No, well, we did back in the early 1200s, but then there was the apocalypse, which, you know, we lost all that knowledge, and now, you know, fortunately, I was there to be able to bring it forward.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah, but, you know, but
it's
wisdom.
Yeah, yes. Remember, Mike, remember your New Year's resolution. It's not working. You were really nice to me. So, because a lot of times in ID, I never knew what the answer was. Is when do you change your treatment? Like, what's the, when you have a prevalence of 45%? I'm pretty sure one would go, yeah, you should change your antibiotic selection. And I've never been able to get a really good answer from infectious disease people. So some people will say 10%, 15%, or whatever. But I think a lot of it depends on the severity of the consequences associated with the infection. So, you know, an abscess, you know, is clearly an infection, but it's probably not life-threatening. So you'd be much more flexible with, you know, when do you really start to worry about MRSA. But I think 45% MRSA, you're going to probably use medications that get MRSA. That's, you know, based on that number.
Mm-hmm. Sounds very reasonable, doesn't it?
Yeah. Which is why they were using clindamycin and trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole.
Absolutely.
But James, like much of medicine, and I think some of your stories from your training are some of the best, you know, it's what feels good. What,
oh yeah. Like,
it's those kind of things that really impact. And so how do you put a, you know, 23.5% prevalence before you switch in it? Like these guys are, you know, a lot of what we do is the evidence plays a role. It absolutely plays a role, but it's your experience, patient beliefs, and what you can, I always used to say, one of the things that makes that in the decision and when I'm confronted with a clinical problem is, will I be able to sleep tonight?
Yeah, no, it's a good threshold to use. And I mean, like, for instance, like if this was the treatment of, you know, meningitis in a child, if there was a 10% chance that it was methicillin resistant staph aureus, you're going to cover for that. You're going to give them.
Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely.
You know, because of the severity of it. But yeah, anyway, we've sort of diverged from something, but it's a really interesting discussion because, and this is not to be critical of our ID colleagues, but a lot of it is a little bit of witchcraft and trying to figure out what to do and how to choose antibiotics and the doses and all that sort of stuff. It's very magical sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what did they find with this? They looked at giving antibiotics to these patients who had abscesses that were being drained.
Absolutely. So after about 1 month, they looked at rates of treatment failure, and it was about 8% in the group that got antibiotics versus 15% in the placebo group. That's a number needed to treat of about 15. Now, one of the systematic reviews, the one that included all different types of antibiotics, they did a specific limitation of limiting it just to studies that did not have MRSA coverage. So, for example, using cefalexin, which does not cover MRSA. And when they did that, the results were no longer statistically significant. So it was based on two small studies, not without really much power, but the trend wasn't even going in the right direction in terms of what it was favoring.
Yeah.
So not really a lot of great information there, but the majority of the evidence really is with drugs that treat and cover MRSA. That's where the benefit seems to be. If you looked at this a little bit farther out, if you looked at it follow-up at 1 to 3 months, then we're looking at failure rates of 18% versus 25% for placebo, with a similar number needed to treat of about 14. And that's the bottom line for the efficacy. If we look at adverse events were similar, 25% for antibiotics versus 22% for placebo, for a number needed to harm of about 38. And I was a little bit surprised about this because in my experience, nobody tolerates clindamycin.
You wouldn't want to exaggerate at all.
No, not at all. Not to make it an absolute.
No, goodness, none of them ever. But in this case, only gastrointestinal adverse events are only about 10% higher with clindamycin than they were for placebo, for a number needed to harm of 11, which I just thought was
and that's the, well, that's the tip. I mean, you're right. I mean, clindamycin is the most common agent antibiotic to cause diarrhea, relatively speaking. It's certainly the I think the highest risk associated with getting C. difficile. But whenever you give out an antibiotic, you say, well, I always say it's about a 10% chance that you're going to get an upset stomach or diarrhea or something like that. You know, it's right around there, and that's fairly consistent with most antibiotics.
But Adrian's right. Clinda has that reputation. Yep. I can recall a conversation between another family physician, myself, and a dentist colleague, and we were talking about treating oral infections, and he was saying, of course, he just gives Clinda. They never have any adverse events. And we reminded him that when you're pooping your pants, you don't come to the dentist.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So his perception of adverse events related to clindamycin is probably biased.
Yeah. And
the decision
was actually kind of shocked.
Because one of the nice things about clindamycin, and where you sometimes see it used, is when a person has a penicillin allergy. That's where we sort of go to the clindamycins or the macrolides and that sort of stuff. But
absolutely.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I, It was always my impression that clindamycin would not be my first line of first line antibiotic of choice for many things because of the adverse effect profile. But yeah,
And the trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, it was about 2% higher than placebo for an amanita to harm of 47 for GI stuff. So overall, like it was better tolerated, like I said, than I thought it was, which was good to see, I suppose. Challenged my own thinking a little bit.
Although you know, it's very tricky because, as we all know, adverse effects like diarrhea and so on are not well captured. So to speak,
that is true.
You know, and even things like, I mean, I'm surprised that the, you know, trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole is 2%, because again, most of the stuff that I've seen is that, you know, at least 5 to 10% of people will get at least some sort of a skin rashy type something or other with it. And so it is tricky because it is a relatively common cause of allergies in people. I mean, sulfur allergies. Go ahead.
This one is for GI effects. So
if they don't talk about, you know, things like skin rash and so on, you know, it's you may be missing some of the other adverse effects that you get with antibiotics.
And some of these two trials, James, you know, they set the bar relatively high for the definition of GI distress, or let's say diarrhea.
Like, yeah, they sometimes include the word explosive.
Which needs no quantification at all, because the very word explosive.
Yeah.
Like projectile vomiting. Like that, you I don't want to hear more about that.
Yeah.
But, you know, they might set the bar at 3 loose stools in a certain hour period or something. And then depending on how strictly you adhere to that before calling something diarrhea. I'm just using an example. I don't even know that that's what they did here, but it's common to, when you know an adverse event's going to occur, you set the bar a little bit higher so it doesn't look quite as bad.
And you're right, because sometimes it is, you know, sometimes their threshold is, was it bad enough to have to stop the antibiotic? Mm-hmm. You know, in all those categories. So I always take the adverse effects data from these sorts of studies with a real grain of salt, because it's tricky to know if you're capturing it properly.
Absolutely. And one other kind of concern that came up with these studies is what happens to people who have diabetes. Because in a lot of cases, I mean, if people have systemic illness or extensive tissue damage, that type of thing, you're probably going to use antibiotics anyway. The question I always have in my mind is, what do you do with people with diabetes? And do these studies really apply well to them? In this case, out of all of the 14 RCTs and the larger systematic review, only 2 of the RCTs actually included patients with diabetes. One of them was one of these nice big new studies from the New England Journal. But even in that case, only 11% of study patients actually had diabetes. So not enough to actually do any kind of a subgroup analysis that would give us really conclusive data on what to do with patients like that. So that's always a bit of a caveat to put with these guys.
For sure.
Yeah. So that's kind of the basics of these systematic reviews and what they found. Like I said, there's a lot of other caveats you can look at for who we treat and how we treat. Most of the guidelines say if they have risk of poor healing or risk of complications like being immunocompromised or have a prosthetic device, that type of thing, those are the ones you'd automatically treat. There was a new guideline that came out in BMJ last year as well. That was actually quite interesting in terms of how they wrote it. They tried to write it with more of a shared informed decision making and patients really determining if they want to use antibiotics perspective, which I really appreciated. And I think it's because when you look at kind of the bottom line of how well these drugs worked and how well incision and drainage alone worked, although it's better with antibiotics, is it really that much better that you would want to cancel out the effects and the possible adverse effects and cost for the patient? So I really like that they took that approach.
Yeah, no, for sure. Because, I mean, even, you know, before this systematic review came out, there was, especially those 2 new randomized controlled trials that came out in the last few years, you know, we didn't recommend antibiotics. But even with this, I mean, you're looking at about 1 in 10 will not have a reoccurrence of the abscess, but about 1 in 10, depending on the drug, will get adverse events. So, you know, I agree with what you guys said at the end here is, in an otherwise healthy person, I don't know if I'd recommend antibiotics. I would just say, you know, here's what you might want to do. Give them a prescription for antibiotics, and they say if it comes back, you might want to start taking them, or come back and see us again and we'll drain it again.
I think that the biggest impact for me from this new research is it makes me feel more comfortable. From in the past, I used to, if the abscess looked quite bad or I was concerned about the patient, et cetera, for a variety of reasons, follow up, what have you, I would add antibiotics. And then I'd go home and feel guilty that I was recklessly using antibiotics, blah, blah, blah. And this now, but the straightforward abscesses that have a very discreet line that's, you know, of redness and inflammation, yeah, that's not really much beyond the abscess itself, and all of those kind of things, and drained really nicely, and the patient's going to have good follow-up. I wasn't giving antibiotics in those cases. And so I think it still stands.
Yeah.
The other, so now it's comfort is one thing. So reassured that I was doing the right thing already, and more comfort. And then the second piece is that I'm going to be using, like, it won't just be adding cephalexin in. for these drained abscesses, it's adding in an agent that's going to cover MRSA, because that seems to be the key piece.
Absolutely.
And you know, it's fascinating to me that here we are, and first of all, Adrian, kudos for using the full name of Salfa throughout this whole podcast.
Thank you, that was very challenging.
I would not have attempted that. It had more than three syllables, so yeah, I bailed. but here we are on a drug that, you know, was really, in many senses, our first antibiotic, and we're
still using it.
We're back to using it as a go-to for resistance. What goes around comes around.
And it's always tricky, I mean, because, you know, I think I've only ever seen one case of, you know, Steven Johnson syndrome, but you do worry about it. You know, it's maybe, who knows what the number is really, but it's probably 1 in 40,000 or something like that with trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. See, that was impressive, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah. But so, you know, we still have to be very respectful of what antibiotics can do, things that we don't want them to do, and so on. So, no, I agree with you, Mike. It really is about what's your comfort level. It's nothing to do with the patient, Mike. Just kidding.
No. But I'm allergic to these antibiotics. Look, I'm going to sleep tonight.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, no, I agree with you. I think in, like you said, with a very defined border in it and no, you know, underlying medical issues, I would definitely, I don't think I would recommend it. I don't think it's worth doing. And
it's not needed.
Yeah. And with all these things, it's just what good follow-up, like how do you make sure, you know, if it comes back, or, you know, that's the key issue is that the person's responsible and you can have good follow up. And if you got that, then I don't know if I'd use antibiotics for that population. But
right,
yeah. So anything else about that?
No.
I didn't think so. So very useful information. We've got about, you know, 1 in 10 benefiting with not having a recurrence of the abscess, but probably somewhere around, depending on the antibiotic, around 1 in 10 getting adverse events from it. And so I don't think we have anything to sell. Mike, do you have any of the webinars coming up?
Just a sec. I did want to say, James, that and I don't know that we hit on this, but the exact, like, these things like perirectal abscesses, mm-hmm, perineal abscesses, perinichii, these things weren't studied in this case. Is that right, Adrian?
Absolutely. They were all excluded from these RCTs.
So we can't extrapolate to everybody, but these are your run-of-the-mill abscesses, right, that we do see. And I think it goes back to what we've talked about lots, allowing clinicians to be clinicians, you know, be comfortable with that these things aren't concrete like we used to talk about, these absolute rules of medicine. And so this allows us some wiggle room to be comfortable prescribing antibiotics or withholding them in patients who, as James had outlined, that really were low risk of having something progress.
You bet. And just the other way to think of it, you mentioned the NNT, we talked about the failure rate. If you do flip it around and actually look at the cure rate, it goes from 85% for incision and drainage up to 92% if you add the antibiotics on. Okay. So that's just another different way to look at it.
Great. Well, there's not much else I think we can add to this topic, but I will make a mention of our Best Science Medicine course here in Vancouver coming up May 3 and May 4. And the two charming people, other than myself, obviously, on this podcast are going to be there doing a number of presentations and putting everything into context and basically telling you everything you need to know about evidence for a variety of different topics. So that's going to be May 3, May 4. It's our 30th anniversary. And for those of you who didn't know that a 30th anniversary is when you give pearls. And and that's our entire course is going to be filled with thousands of, you know what, I'm not even going to exaggerate, tens of thousands of pearls.
No, thank God you're not exaggerating.
I know. So we would love it if you could show up. There's usually 300 to 400 family docs and pharmacists and all sorts of other healthcare providers, nurses, and we have a bunch of naturopathic physicians. We have all sorts of people showing up to this course, and we would love it if you guys could show up. And I think that's it. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.
Bye.